Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott, episode 31 for July 20th, 2007, Computing in the Clouds. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/windows. Pay no attention to that hissing you hear. It is merely the sound of the Dedham air conditioning system kicking into high gear. It's Paul Thurrott in a very hot... How hot is it?
It's so hot, Leo. No, mostly it's muggy.
Muggy.
And it's just sticky. It's the type of thing where you get up out of the chair and the chair is still attached to your butt. That kind of thing.
You got to stop using
maybe
the Naga hide.
Maybe that doesn't happen to you. I don't know.
No, I sit on a ball, you know. I sit on an exercise ball. So nothing sticks to me, boy. It rolls right off. But we don't get the humidity you get. I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember that from when I was in Providence growing up.
Ugh. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I think everybody will tolerate just a little bit of hiss to avoid... The fragrance of Paul melting in the in the sun. We got lots to talk about. First of all, apologies for missing last week, but I was in Vancouver. And apologies also to those who thought we might do this one live. We had said we would do the 19th live. We are not going to because there's just too much to talk about. But we're hoping to do it live via Talk Show next week. So that we tape these the day before. So that'll be the 27th of July. No, the 26th of July. If my addition is correct, and at talkshoe.com. And we do it usually at 4 p.m. Eastern time. So shoot for that, and apologies to those who went to TalkShoe and didn't see us because we weren't there. Also, the week following, we're going to take a couple of weeks off. Paul's going to France. I'm going to Vancouver the week after that. Once I get back and Paul's situated in France, we'll do the show via Skype from his chateau.
From my friend's chateau.
You go to France every year, don't you?
Yeah.
Is that family there, or just because you love it? Or
no, we love it. We have friends there.
That's nice.
So, yeah.
You actually have a friend with a chateau?
A chateau. Well, every house in France is a chateau, Leo.
Of course, yes.
Sure.
Un homme's maison est...
Yeah,
son château.
That's a Maison Thoreau.
Maison Thoreau. Chez Thoreau.
Yeah.
Actually, it still would be Thoreau because you got two T's in there. All right, let's demolish some rumors right here and now. Lots of news about SP1 for Vista. I probably even reported it on my radio show or on Twit that SP1 was going to be out any day now.
Yeah.
Lies.
That's just, well, I don't know. You know, these things get started because somebody says something to somebody and, you know, I think there are just misunderstandings. And
I know fully now how rumors get started because about a month, more like in January, Merlin Mann made up a rumor about a Beatles iPod.
Yes.
And this
gets reported every 2 months. Here it comes. It's going to be yellow.
Yeah.
It's going to look like the yellow submarine.
Yeah.
And it's
he made it up. So I know completely how these things, you know, just, did you hear? I heard.
You know what happens? You know, people want to believe so bad.
Right. Yeah.
And I was just, I put a sort of a snide comment about SP1 in my instant messaging application. I got a couple of queries today from people who were saying, what's the problem here exactly? And I said, you know what the problem is? So many Windows guys, and by Windows guys, I mean, you know, people involved in the Windows community, you know, the Windows bloggers, Windows enthusiasts, whatever, have been so down on Vista. Right, you hear nothing but complaints. But for some reason, SP1, Service Pack 1 for Vista, has generated this level of excitement that just doesn't make any sense because, A, it's just a collection of bug fixes.
Right.
It's not going to it's not going to dramatically change the Vista experience in any way whatsoever. And, B, you know, these guys were dumping on Vista for the past 6 months. So that we can all be duped again and again by this kind of silliness is just depressing.
Well,
and
I think there are a lot of people who have said, I've heard him say, I'm waiting to Service Pack 1. I may even have said...
Well, yeah, but that's... the I would assume that the people who are saying that are either, you know, in businesses or related to business in some ways, or just very conservative. I mean, right. I think from the consumer standpoint, most people are just waiting to get a new PC. You know, most people today.
That's when it goes.
Yeah,
that's
they just trigger. Get a PC and they get Vista. And, yeah. You know, and those people, you know, by and large, will love Vista. There's no doubt about it.
I think we're talking about upgraders.
Yeah.
And my recommendation, I have to say, has been don't rush to upgrade unless you have some compelling reason to.
Or unless you absolutely hate yourself.
And you like the
pain.
I get
into this thing where, you know, obviously I beta test a lot of software, and there's a small period of time, a short period of time after every OS release or every big software release where I just sort of revel in the using of something that's new and done.
Right.
But then over time, I start getting kind of itchy and I want to start running beta software again, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for people like me, and we have a problem, we have to admit this, that, you know, you want to get excited about the next thing. And, you know, unfortunately at Microsoft, the way things are right now is the Windows division is run by a Kremlin style, you know, veil of silence, and they don't want to talk about anything. And,
and the next thing, this we should make clear, the next thing, as you said, isn't a lot of new features, a brand new look. It's not like Service Pack 2 was for XP even. It's just bug fixes.
Right. And I used to always write of Service Pack releases that if everything goes right, when you install this thing, you really shouldn't notice anything different.
That's more how they've been in the past. Service Pack 2 changed kind of how we think
about it. Service Pack 2 and XP was obviously a big deal.
Yeah. The other thing is I think that people are waiting. They want some sign of signpost that it's okay to use XP, or rather a Vista. So they use that as kind of a signpost. Well, it's mature enough that now there's a service pack. It's not necessarily that we're waiting for the bug fixes. We just want to give it some time, and that's a reasonable signpost.
Yeah. I had a conversation with Microsoft probably, 2 or 3 months before Vista was released. It was finalized. And they asked me, you know, what do we need to do to get people off of this SP1 thing? You know, we want people to believe that the initial shipping version of this is high quality enough that they can just go out and get it and not have to worry about it. And I just sort of laughed and I said, guys, you're never going to get rid of that. You would have to ship so many high quality versions of Windows in a row before anyone would ever believe that. There's just too many people out there with very deep memories of problems and disappointments and things not working, and it's just the way it is, you know.
That's too bad.
And certainly Vista didn't change it. Vista is very high quality, but all you hear about are those compatibility issues, and it doesn't matter if it's a much smaller percentage of people than it was, say, in the XP timeframe, which it is. You know, the reality is that stuff gets spread around, and that's what people hear. So
Microsoft has told you there is no that Service Pack 1 is not going to be out any day soon, or what did they say?
Well, no, what they did was they issued a public statement which they shipped around to people, and what they said was there will be a Windows Vista Service Pack. The beta will happen sometime this year, which is what they said previously. They were shooting for toward the end of the year. And the final release will occur sometime next year. But what they're trying to say really is that, they didn't come out and say this explicitly, but the idea is we're not shipping this thing this week. We're not shipping it next week. I mean, service packs are only one part of what Microsoft does to improve Windows over time. And especially, I would say, in XP timeframe and now in Vista. They do a lot more to ship updates through Windows Update or Microsoft Update or just through the web. You know, we talked last time about the photo sharing application in Windows Vista is essentially going to be upgraded with a Windows Live version of that product that will have new features. And that's, you know, the way they kind of do things now. The major functional releases, the things that are actually interesting to people, like a new version of Photo Gallery, will actually ship outside of Windows between Windows releases. So, you know, there's no real reason to wait for Service Pack 1. And they actually specifically addressed the device issue. You know, they said that as of today, there are more than 2.1 million supported devices and more than 2,000 logoed applications for Windows Vista. So,
but that doesn't really address the individual issue my printer doesn't work. I'm not having any problems. But, let's use Chris Perillo's example. That's why he went back to XP.
Yeah. Please. Let's use the one guy who can't get Windows Vista working. So,
you could say 2.1 million and 2,000, but if it's not that particular one, what they don't say is how many devices don't work with Vista.
What I'm actually wondering here is if Microsoft is specifically not shipping the driver for Chris Prillo's printer just to mess with them. Because it just seems it's just so diabolical at this point.
So would you? No, that would be.
I don't know. Just a theory.
Would you tell people not to upgrade to Vista yet, or would you say it's okay to go ahead? I'm talking about people using XP right now.
But nobody normal should ever upgrade an operating system ever, ever,
ever.
There is no compelling reason to do that. Never. And what I mean, normal people.
So right? Do it. You're saying do it when you buy a new PC.
Absolutely.
And not until then.
No. No. And by the way, there are excellent tools available now so that if you buy a brand new PC, you can suck out all of your data, your application settings, your personalized settings, et cetera, from your old computer, plug in a cable, blast them all back to the new Vista install. You know, you can even do that stuff. So, there's just no reason to hurt yourself in the short term and try to do an upgrade. I mean, and that's really always been the case, hasn't it? I mean,
yeah, no,
not that
right.
many people go and buy an upgrade version of Windows and then actually, you know, run setup and upgrade it, you know. I'm doing a series now on the Supersite about these processes that you can go through to install Vista. And there's so many different ways, you know, to get Vista onto a computer. You can dual boot, you know, clean install, upgrade. You can use the upgrade version and do a clean install, you know. Yeah, you can run them on Macs now. I mean, there's all these different things that you can do. And honestly, you know, when I write things like this, I mean, I honestly feel that parts are ever going to undergo this process. I just don't think it makes any sense.
Do you,
you know, these kinds of people.
Do you, how about people who are buying new computers who are choosing XP? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's happening in business more than at home.
Yeah.
Is that?
Well, I know a couple of people who did that. And in both cases, the laptops were sort of a dual use thing. They were going to work from home. They had to install very specific software, you know, VPN type thing, whatever. Yeah. And both of them said, you know, I had to get Vista. I mean, I was told that if I wanted to use this and work from home, I had to get Vista. And I'm sorry, I had to get XP, not Vista. And yeah, so they wanted, in both cases, would have liked to have gone to Vista, but didn't really have that option. So it's hard for me to wrap my mind around this. I mean, even if I wasn't doing what I was doing, I would want Vista now, personally. And you know when you buy a new computer that it's going to work fine. So I would want the latest one. I don't buy last year's car.
Right.
For the same price, you know, you might make that decision because it's cheaper. If an XP computer was $200 cheaper, maybe you would have a compelling reason to do that.
I also, though, think that it's a little different than a car. I mean, it's like not like they changed where the steering wheel is on a car. And,
sure.
And Vista's, you know, I mean, it's very different. So that's for some people, a discouragement and some people an encouragement. I mean, I personally upgraded an XP machine to Vista because I wanted Vista. I wanted the new UI, and I've been very happy with it. So,
I think for me personally, and this may not be true of everyone, but when you spend time in any new version of a software product, if it's Windows or Office, whatever, to me, the proof, so to speak, in how valuable this thing is to you is to go back to the old version and discover whether or not you can stand it anymore. And I have to say, I go back to things like Office 2003, or I go back to Windows XP, and I don't like being there.
Yeah.
I just don't.
No, I agree with you. Yeah.
I miss things. And, you know, we can talk on and on and on about is Vista a huge upgrade? Is it compelling, et cetera? But I honestly do miss things. You know, like start menu search immediately. The ability to tap the start menu. And you go back to Vista and you don't, XP rather, and you don't have that. And it's disconcerting. And you actually have to sit there and think, well, wait a minute. Where is this thing? I don't even know where it is. You know?
Topic two. Computing in the clouds. Get your head out of the clouds, Therat.
Right. I want to get my head in the cloud.
What is cloud computing? What are you talking about when you say that?
Well, it's what Google is doing. You know, we all have this theory that there's going to be a Google PC, you know, and that in the age of pervasive internet access, we can run everything up on a server somewhere.
Oh, the cloud and being the internet. So computing.
The cloud is the internet.
I got it. Computing in the
It's internet. Not a haze of insecurity or whatever.
Yeah.
Although smoke. It could be.
Everybody loves this, rightly, and the Google spreadsheet.
Everyone, well, except for Microsoft, right? I mean, you know, this is a company that has been around for, 30 years now. They've made a lot of money making traditional PC software that ships in some physical form in a box, and you install it on a physical PC, and you know, you pay for it, that kind of thing. They've been very slow moving to the internet. I would say every step along the way, they were slow to the initial internet and the web. They were slow to this web point 2.0 stuff that we're doing now. And you can look at a company like Google, which has really gotten it. And Google's even killing companies that kind of do get it, like Yahoo, obviously, which is almost purely a cloud computing sort of company.
Right.
They're getting killed too. So there have been many interesting developments over the years. There was a group inside Microsoft that was working on a version of Office that would reside solely online. And the project was called NetDocs. And NetDocs was brought into the Office group and just ceremoniously killed, you know, by Steven Sinofsky, who, by the way, now runs Windows, and never to be seen again.
And yet, I've always had the impression that Microsoft wanted to rent software, and this is one way to kind of rent software.
Sure, but you know, you have to remember too, when we talk about Microsoft, Microsoft is a humongous company, and so within the company, there's lots of debate. There are lots of people who feel like we do about the way things should be done. There are people who feel like things should be done a different way, and then there are the people who feel that Microsoft should just keep doing what they do. Those people have made some crazy decisions, like bundling IE into Windows, et cetera, et cetera.
Really, you think that's crazy? I mean, I know it cost them a lot of legal.
Well, it was crazy from a sort of a technical stability and security standpoint, yes. Because at that time, you know, the Windows NT operating system was very stable, had excellent underpinnings, excellent technical background, et cetera. Yeah. And a bunch of 23-year-old kids came in and wrote a quickie web browser, and
stick it in there. It'll really be good.
They basically think, not only are we going to put it in the product, we're going to make it the shell.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to put that right in the kernel, and it's going to be great. Yeah.
Just think how easy it'll be to run applications from the web all the time. It'll be great.
Exactly. So anyway, 10 years later, we've been paying for this ever since.
Good point.
Ever since. So they have finally come around. I mean, there aren't a lot of details, but what they basically said last week at a partner conference was that they're going to start delivering software in three different ways. It won't be everything. Obviously, they're going to try to do things where they most make sense. But for the first time, they basically said, we are going to create software products that exist up in the cloud and compete directly with our traditional software. Finally.
That's great. Will it be through Windows Live, you think, or some other?
Yeah, they're coming up with the platform that they're calling this is actually called Windows Live Core. And the other big piece of this, and this is clearly very important, is that Windows Live Core and all the Windows Live stuff will be opened up to third-party developers so that people can build off of that stuff, improve it in different ways, and write their own products, just like they do for Windows or Office or whatever other platforms that Microsoft makes. So that's one thing I'd have to say, you know, for all the they don't get it stuff, the one thing that Microsoft has always gotten is that the way you make an ecosystem is you create a platform and you let people write to it. So
there'll be plugins for Windows Live Core? There'll be...
Yeah, I would assume. I mean, we'd have to speculate at this time. But if you think about some of the stuff that's going on with, you know, Windows Live today, you could look at something like Hotmail and say, well, how about if we could write something that would, you know, plug into Hotmail and I don't know, supply, you know, word style grammar and spelling checking or something in the editor. I guess the ideal would be that whatever they make and whatever's coming down the pike will be as open to third party developers through public APIs. As is Windows, especially, would
That's
be the
cool.
big example.
That would be very cool. Will it be .NET? I guess it'll be .NET, yeah?
I would assume so, yeah. We're going to have to wait for the next big developer conference. And you may recall, we talked about PDC being canceled this year. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to say, in retrospect, part of that might have been because of this. Because if you think about developer shows going forward that Microsoft might have, this is what people are going to want to talk about. Not just the next versions of Windows and Office, which will always be interesting, but also this next generation platform that sort of transcends Windows and Office.
Right. Right. Well, I have to say, in a way, you know, we've been kind of in a stasis, and I even feel it in the show, where it's Vista, 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 you know, the ramp up
exactly.
to Vista. Now Vista's out, and there's just kind of let down, and there's nothing, you know, and now it almost seems like Microsoft is getting back into gear and saying, okay, now what? Where do we go next? And
exactly. It's an emotional roller coaster, Leo.
It's not easy being Redmond.
It's been my life for the last 10 years.
But I'm pleased to see that what they're doing is saying what's next and looking at what's going on in the real world and saying, maybe this is where we ought to be.
Right. And, you know, I sort of broached this topic a little bit. I've, you know, switched my email up to Gmail. I've moved my calendar onto Google Calendar. I've uploaded almost 25 gigabytes of photos to Picasa and so forth. And increasingly, as you do more of this stuff up in the cloud, you know, on the internet, it really frees up a lot of things. Obviously, if you can't get online, there's a problem. But, you know, I've been waltzing around with the iPhone lately, and this is true of any Windows mobile phone, too. Anywhere you can, if you can get internet access on a phone, it's neat to be able to do things like triage email on a mobile device or access your calendar, you know?
Yep.
Whatever. You know, Google Group, Google Reader, which is an incredible mobile application, by the way, is a great way to keep up with news out wherever you might be. So if you're sitting in a doctor's office, you have 15 minutes to kill, whatever.
Looks good on the iPhone. I was actually in line for my iPhone with a guy who had just been up till 3 in the morning getting Google Reader to work on the iPhone nicely.
Oh, yeah. Google Reader, it might be the best iPhone app yet.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And they actually did that before it came out.
What's interesting about it is that it's just text, you know, but it looks great. I mean, it's just beautiful.
So I agree with you. And it's funny because for a long time, years ago, I poo-pooed this whole idea of network-centric computing.
Sure.
But I think we've become more comfortable with the idea of having a lot of our life online. And boy, is it convenient.
Yes. When Sun said the network is the computer, nobody knew what they were talking about.
That's right. It was like, what?
Yeah, today the network is the computer because honestly, it's more important for my stuff to be out there than it is to be locked on a hard drive in my home.
The boundary of your computer doesn't stop with that CPU.
Right.
It expands way beyond that.
It's a huge paradigm shift.
Yeah. And we have, it's taken a while, but I think we have become comfortable with it, partly because broadband has become more ubiquitous and it's pretty reliable. I mean, your internet doesn't go out that often. I think we're more comfortable with the notion that. Now, of course,
this is what I remember too. Years and years ago, Microsoft used to talk about broadband. Back when broadband was ISDN, you know, remember it was a 128K per channel or something.
I had it. Yep.
And you may I remember Microsoft guys used to tell me they could get ISDN at home, and they had to dedicate 128K just to work email, and the other 128K they could do whatever they wanted because they had to be connected to work. You know, today of course 128K is hilarious unless you're using the edge network, but.
I'd be happy with that. Edge.
Broadband has reached that thing that they used to talk about, which is it has to be like electricity.
Right.
You have to take it for granted. It just has to kind of be there. And when it does go out, it has to be surprising and unwelcome.
Right.
You know, we're absolutely there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, maybe I'm sure there are people listening who download this on a dial up and they're going, oh, those fancy snobs.
Ivy Tower, East Coast.
I think this is true.
God, there are cities around the United States and I'm sure in Europe as well where public Wi-Fi is just a matter of course. You know, they're doing that in Cambridge, they're doing it in Boston, I know they're doing it in New York, I'm sure San Francisco has it all over the place. This is a big deal right now.
And look, we're sitting here talking over the public internet and just completely taking it for granted.
Right. Abusing it, one might say.
It might be, yeah. I mean, but seriously. So I don't think you're alone. It's interesting that you're using so many Google applications. I guess it's because there's a dearth of Microsoft applications.
But for the grace of God, and I have to tell you, and this is sort of a dirty little secret, but had Microsoft opened up the live.com accounts to the public when they released Hotmail, I probably just would have gone live.com and never even really paid attention to what was going on with Gmail. I'm not using a Hotmail account. I know that's a silly reason to, make a dramatic shift toward, you know, Google instead of Microsoft, but
it's little things like that though.
That's the
real world. Yeah.
So,
I'm got a couple of gigs of email on Gmail, it's hard to move. So that's something Microsoft and everybody else should pay attention to. There's a stickiness to these.
A Gmail exporter might be a good product for Microsoft to create for Hotmail.
Kidding.
Maybe I'll take advantage of that someday. But I have to say, you know, so far I've been happy with the experiences. I've never experienced a major outage with any of this stuff. The only problem I've ever had really is I have almost too many photos on Picasa Web. It's almost unwieldy.
Right.
Just to load the page.
And Flickr or something like that you wouldn't consider using, or do you use that as well?
I actually do have a Flickr account. In fact, I had a Flickr account for much longer than Google. And the only reason I stuck with Google, honestly, was that I wanted to keep this stuff all in the same place. Because I feel like there's going to be some synergy between the Google stuff where I might be able to more seamlessly access Picasa stored photos from Blogger, which I also use, or whatever. You know, that these things will interoperate better off the bat. And that's the reason I just stuck with Google.
I could just hear them crying in Redmond right now.
Well, keep trying. I'm up for grabs. You know, I'm not.
He's available.
I'm not saying, I'm not saying I'm never going to leave, but I, you know, for now, this is working great. It's fine. It works really well.
Speaking of working, Windows Home Server has been in beta for a while. It's now ready for prime time. And I tell you, everybody I've talked to who uses it loves it. Mm-hmm. Are you using it?
Yeah. I need to. I haven't gotten final code yet.
Tell us what it is first. Actually,
I'm sorry. Tell you what it is.
Yeah.
It's basically a PC operating system that's based on Windows Server, Small Business Edition. It's been stripped down dramatically. You can actually boot into it from the machine, you know, from the machine you install it to. But typically, what they want you to do is access it from a very friendly front end. It's sort of a web-like dashboard that you would access over your network. And it does a bunch of different things, but it does the stuff you would expect, right? It does things like provide digital media sharing, so you can put all your photographs up there. You can put your family photos, your music collection, whatever it might be. Put all this stuff up there, and it will, you know, you can access it from around the network, et cetera, et cetera. But it actually does some amazing things related to storage. You can plug in internal or external hard drives. It will actually pool all the storage. If you have data that's very important, you can mark it as being special so that it will actually keep two copies of that data on two or more different physical hard drives. So that if there is a hardware failure, you won't lose the only copy of, you know, your baby's photographs or whatever.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, and it provides remote access to all of the PCs in your house if you want to have that feature. So that if you are out on the road, so I'm going to France next month, conceivably, I could actually hit the front, you know, the web front end to this server and access my home, my, you know, desktop computer and get a file off of it while I was halfway around the world. And that's pretty neat.
Yeah, France is just as local as anywhere else now.
Yeah. Now, I've been paying for a service to do that. I use something called LogMeIn, which is a great service.
Yep.
And I pay for that, and it gives me access to a Windows server I have here at home that has copies of all my data, and et cetera.
So this would replace that.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I've actually got both of these things running side by side, and I'm duplicating information, and I'm trying to decide if this thing can, in fact, replace the Windows server. And I think that it will. Right now, I have some router issues for remote access. I have to get a router that's on the approved list and so forth to enable that functionality. But
how does Windows Home Server handle the router and all of those configuration things? Is it pretty transparent?
Yeah, it is if you have a newer router. So if you have a UPnP2 type router that can be automatically configured externally, it will configure all of the ports and everything for what you're going to do. So if you're not going to enable remote access, it will configure the router so that nothing external gets in, and that's vice versa. Yeah,
we've in the past, Steve Gibson has kind of recommended people turn off UPnP on a router, but this is UPnP2,
right?
Which is
well, I'm sure he doesn't like that either. He is
well, we don't like the idea that the program running on your computer can tell your router, open up the firewall, here I come. Right. But if they put some security or certification or something in there,
There have been security issues with UPnP.
We don't know about UPnP, too. We'll watch. I'll ask Steve about it. Maybe he can check into it.
He will laugh and laugh. I think on the scale from security on one end to functionality on the other, he is much further to the security end than I am.
Absolutely. You know? But maybe for good reason.
By definition, yeah. Oh, absolutely for a good reason, sure.
Yeah. No, he and I fight over scripting all the time. I say, but I can't use the web without scripting. I'm sorry. I'm not going to turn off scripting. And he's right. It's dangerous, but there's some things you just need. And this might be an example. It might be impossible to get Windows Home Server working without a little help.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, even in my case, I have a gaming router. It's not particularly old, but I guess it doesn't have this latest spec that you need. And I really like it. It does some interesting things for if you play games online. It actually optimizes throughput for that. And that's actually worked out really well. I can get, you know, two Xbox 360s out playing on the same server, which shouldn't be possible from the same IP address, but it works fine with this router. And I really like that stuff. So I'm a little nervous about switching the routers, although, of course, I will do that eventually.
Yeah. No, I love it. I have a D-Link gaming gear. I imagine it's the same one. And it's been
That's actually what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love it. Now, maybe they'll put it in firmware or something and give us that capability. That's possible.
Yeah, I'll look at it.
So now, the other question people were asking is Windows Home Server, will it require a hardware purchase, or will you be able to buy the software and put it on an old leftover PC somewhere?
Right. So they are going to sell it in two ways, but you're not going to be able to go into Best Buy or a place like that and purchase a retail box copy of it. The way it will work is typically you'll buy it with new server hardware. And there's some really innovative and neat looking server hardware coming from all the typical suspects, including companies like Lacy and iOmega. You know, some of the guys who make those network attached storage boxes are also making Windows Home servers. And for people who do just want to get the software, you know, install it on their own PCs, you'll be able to go to the places where you can get OEM versions of software. What's the new software, et cetera? I always forget the online version.
Newegg.
Newegg, thank you. I'm an old guy.
You just dated yourself big time.
I went into a software, et cetera, the day that NT4 shipped.
Wow.
And
did you buy NT4 there?
I did, and I was soaking wet because I had gone to a party and someone pushed me in a pool. And so I was like the swamp thing, making like a little puddle every step I took. And the guy's looking at me like, what are you doing? And I said, I have to buy NT. So, anyway,
he took your $500 happily, gladly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This memory is just embedded in
software, etc. And then an Egghead.
Egghead.
Yeah,
that's actually what I'm thinking of.
Well, no, they were both.
No, it was software, etc.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't. You know, I always thought that Newegg was related to Egghead, and it's not. Somebody told me it's not. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know. Well,
we know what you're talking about.
That these places sell. You know, Windows Media Center, for example, before Vista came out, you could get Media Center that way.
Right.
And they would sell.
You would have to do some token purchase of a piece of hardware.
Yeah, USB key, serial cable.
Just to justify it.
Something like that.
I'm an OEM.
It certainly works fine installing it that way. You know, so if you're a do-it-yourselfer, you can do that.
What kind of hardware would you need to make this work?
It's actually not very dramatic. It's Celeron class CPU, 512 megs of RAM. It's really not a big deal. The system I have it installed on, if I remember correctly, I want to say it's it's a Sempron something. I don't know, 1.8, 1.6, wow. You know, gigabit.
It doesn't need much. And of course, you'd want a lot of hard drive space because you're going to use it.
Yep. You want to load it up with hard drive space. So I bought a couple of external 512 gigabyte drives, and it has an external drive. And, you know, it just pulls all that stuff together and it works great, and you can just plug stuff in. You just keep plugging more in, and it will just suck it all up and put it in the pool.
How does it compare to, say, a network-attached storage unit, a NAS?
Well, it's a full system, so it has all that additional functionality, right?
So it's a real Windows system.
Right, and well, you don't even have to think of it as a Windows system because technically you're just accessing it from this web-like dashboard. But it is a Windows system from a sharing standpoint. So if you have a Media Center PC or an Xbox out in your living room, you can access the shares on this thing as you would any Windows machine. So one of the nice things about this, I would say unlike Media Center perhaps, is that it actually does benefit from being Windows because you get all that functionality that you would expect from a Windows machine.
Right.
And by the way, we talked about APIs. They have an SDK so that developers can ship add-ons that will they actually have a formal add-on capability, and they're having a contest and actually going to be part of the judging for that. So in September, all of the people who have submitted their Windows Home Server add-ons, you know, to the contest, will judge those. And
I'm getting excited about this. I think I want to take, I have an old machine somewhere. I think it's dual Celerons. I'd like to see if it'll work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it should work.
It supports multiprocessing, I presume.
Yep.
Yeah. Update on Windows Live OneCare. Now, version 2 is out in beta. What's new in version 2?
All kinds of stuff. You know, Windows Live OneCare, of course, is antivirus, anti-spyware. It's got an enhanced firewall and other features. But this time around in 2.0, it's interesting. They're bringing some of the Vista security stuff down level to XP. So, for example, the Wi-Fi connection stuff where you can configure your network connection as being, you know, for home, work, or public will actually be brought down to XP via OneCare, which is kind of neat.
That is neat. I wish they'd move user access control down with that.
Well, yeah, I don't think we're going to see that one.
No.
It actually takes or begins a notion of multiple PC management. So that in the past, you could sort of go around and install multiple copies of this product on different PCs. So in a multi-PC household, mm-hmm. it's licensed for up to three computers. Mm-hmm. But now they have the concept of a hub PC, and this is where you know you, the manager of your home's PCs, would set notification dates about the health of the entire network, not just your own computer, but all the other computers. So if your kid maybe turned off the firewall so you could play a video game, you could actually just you know click a button and make sure that went back to its default state.
It's kind of like enterprise class monitoring now, SNMP and stuff.
When they first started talking about this, I thought of this as an administrator in a box,
right?
You know, for home users, and it's getting even more like that, I would say, in this version. So that now, stuff is kind of neat.
I have to say that I actually loved OneCare One and installed it on all my systems, and I did love how smoothly it integrated. It just felt like it was adding to the capabilities, not a big old heavy thing hanging off the side of it. But I stopped recommending it because of the ratings in on AV comparatives. On AV comparatives in the last test, that only 82% of the viruses were detected.
Sure. So I asked them about that because, you know, that's the same thing. For me personally, I liked OneCare, the initial version, 1.5.
I recommended it for newbies because I thought this is as simple as it can get.
It seemed to work well. My only complaint about it from a functional perspective is that it had too many pop-ups. You know, OneCare just protected you against this, or OneCare changed the way your firewall is working. You know, who cares? Why are you doing this? And I don't need to know that you're blocking outbound traffic.
Right.
Just do it.
This
version doesn't appear to fix that, but we'll see. But with regards to the complaint that this product doesn't provide a lot of protection, what they told me was that you know, OneCare is actually certified by the most well-respected security product testers out there, ICSA Labs, West Coast Labs, et cetera, the VBA 100, and so forth.
I always recommended looking for ICSA certification. That to mm-hmm. me meant, well, you know, it is a competent antivirus.
Yeah.
So what they
told me was that that 82% that you're referring to actually refers to a test in which apparently, there are virus writers who create viruses in labs that never get out into the real world, and that's what that encompasses.
Oh,
that when you actually take out the non-real threats, the ones that never actually got out there in the first place, it's right up there with everything else.
Oh, and, interesting.
You know, I don't have anything scientific to tell you about this. In my own experience, it works fine. You know, but then again, in my own experience, I've been using AVG, you know, free. On some systems, an AVG Pro on my X64 system, and that works fine too. So I don't, you know, who can
well,
say? But
and you're probably like me. The more sophisticated users would know what not to do. So the virus is
maybe you know. But I would also say on the other side, guys like us tend to install more junk off the internet too. And
have you? But
that's
okay,
a little promiscuous from a you know from a software standpoint.
Well, let me put it this way: How when's the last virus alert you've gotten that you have a virus or
like actual virus?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been over 3 years.
Well, that's my point.
And that was only because I opened up the firewall in the beta version of XP SP2 to print a file and forgot to turn it back on.
Right.
And,
well, that's exactly my point. Is I think that. We are not going to be getting viruses. So an antivirus is almost a second line of defense, and it's not critical that it be 100% effective. I do think that the things that I like about OneCare are it's not the antivirus scanner, but it's the overall, and you just mentioned a couple of good points, overall security enhancements that it makes.
Right. If your PC is sitting behind a hardware router, which it should be, you've got a firewall, and you've got you know anti-spyware, antivirus.
And you don't open attachments and...
Right. You've got a phishing filter in your browser.
Yeah.
And you're not a complete idiot, you know.
Right.
You should be okay.
Yeah, you're pretty safe.
I mean, a lot is made of how insecure Windows systems are. But the truth is, and I think I've said this before, you don't have to do a heck of a lot to keep a system secure. But I think the thing that's nice about OneCare, too, with this, especially if you have multiple PCs, is you have that sort of network health beacon sitting there that you can see everything is okay right now.
Right.
And you don't have to go over to your wife's computer or your child's computer to see that. You can see it from your own computer. And I think that's actually kind of a neat feature that a lot of people are going to like.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. So at this point you're saying, now it's a beta. Does that mean I can use it free for a while or?
Yeah, it's a public beta right now. So anyone can get it.
Download it.
Yeah.
Windows Live OneCare and it's, is it OneCare.com? Is that? I think it was.
No, you know, I was just looking for that. I can give you the address. It is Right. It's something complicated. So it's get.
No, live. I think you can go to onecare.com.
Okay.
And they have a link. You totally can. Okay, 90-day free trial. Now, this is not for the beta. This is for the existing.
Well, make sure it's the 2.0 beta. So
so you're right. That would be the longer URL, because I don't see any reference to a beta here.
Yeah, okay. So actually, you could do this. You could go to the super site, and I have a link to that on my, where is it?
There you go.
I have a Windows, I have a preview, a document that explains all the new features, but I also have a screenshot gallery, and on the screenshot gallery page, there's a link to the download.
So that's winsupersite.com, Paul's website.
Yeah.
Best way to get it.
There you go.
Should just say that from now
Simplest
on.
Simplest way to get it, Paul.
Hey, before we go on, we've got lots more to talk about, including the Xbox 360 and, you know, some maybe some trouble with the government for Microsoft. But and don't forget our software pick of the week. But we do have to do a book pick right now. Audible.com is a sponsor of this podcast and almost all the podcasts on the Twit Network. And we just are thrilled about it because Paul and I are Audible customers from way back. And we do have a deal for you. If you're not yet an Audible subscriber, you can get a free credit towards a book. Most cases, this will cover an entire book, just depends on the book, by going to audible.com/windows, audible.com/windows, and signing up. Now, if you decide you don't like it, it'll no cost to you, no obligation, but I have a feeling, I should warn you, you're going to start getting hooked. Paul and I just, you know, we can't stop listening to these.
Especially if you commute. I don't want to say I wish I commuted, but if I did.
I do.
It is the one thing, I don't get to drive around a lot, but if I did... this is the type of thing
you can put them on CD or you can put them on almost any MP3 player. They actually work great on the iPhone, and I've moved all my books over to the iPhone because I have it with me all the time. Mm-hmm. So what's your recommendation for this week?
It is a classic, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes.
Douglas Adams. It's read by Stephen Fry, who was also excellent.
I love him.
Fans of British, you know, TV comedy like Blackadder. He goes back a long ways. And,
he was, I think, I'm trying to remember, he played a part in the original radio show. I don't know if it was...
Oh, of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yeah, I don't know if it was the book or... Mm-hmm. But he was, I'm pretty sure he was in it. Let me play a little snippet of it, just because you'll recognize his voice immediately. He's just so wonderful. This is a good way to listen to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Of all knowledge and wisdom. Although it has many omissions and contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, it scores over the older, more pedestrian work in two important respects. First, it is slightly cheaper, and second, it has the words "Don't Panic" inscribed in large, friendly letters on its cover.
I love Stephen Fry.
He talks and I hear Lord Melchie, you know, back and forth. Yeah, he's great. And, you know, this is the next best thing. Unfortunately, Douglas Adams, of course, has passed away. This is probably the next best thing to having, you know, him read it himself.
I agree. The whole trilogy is available. It is online at audible.com. And if you want to set up an account and get that first book free, you can. audible.com/windows. And we thank Audible for their support. Another great recommendation. You got off the horror topic.
I had to. I need something I can lay in the dark and listen to.
This just makes me smile. I just love this. I heard it first as a BBC radio play, and that's, I think, the first way it was produced. And I wish that
I remember being on TV as well. Wasn't there a BBC TV version?
TV, yeah. And then we won't talk about the movie version.
I refused to see the movie.
Oh, you were that so movie. Smart. Oh, it was awful.
I can't do it. I can't. It reminds me of the movie I, Robot.
Yep.
Where I read an excellent review where the guy said, you know, first let's discuss the things that are the same between the book and the movie, the title. Now that we've done that.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And it's just not right.
No, not with a venerable title like that. You don't want to mess with that. Not at all. All right, let's move on. We've got much more this is going to be the longest episode in our history, but there's a lot going on. This is one of the reasons we didn't do the live call-in today because, so much
there's
more now.
There's so much, yeah.
This happened right after we put out the podcast 2 weeks ago, so it's kind of old news, but I would like to get your thoughts on it.
We complained and complained and complained.
We were talking about the Xbox 360 failure rate, right? And Microsoft, shortly after we did that, I'm not going to take credit, but shortly, maybe we should.
I think you are.
No, I think we should. I think we did it. No, shortly after, I'm sure it was in the works.
Like the Stephen Colbert, we did it thing.
Yeah, we did that. Yes, we did it. $1.1 billion or more earmarked for warranty repairs. They're going to extend the warranty on all Xbox 360s. They will acknowledge, you get that three rings of death, boy, they will acknowledge it and immediately replace it, they say. Good for them.
Good for them. Good for us. I mean, and for anyone who uses an Xbox 360.
They even said if you'd brought it in before to get it fixed, they'd pay for it.
They'll pay you back.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is disgusting because they've known about this forever. And for them to claim otherwise is just... it's just terrible. And this is a huge embarrassment. And I'm sure I said this last time, you know, that I've told this story so many times, I can't recall, you know, if I did it on the show or not. But, you know, when I went to Microsoft and saw the development systems and I said, how are you going to squeeze this into the little box? You know, and they said, oh, no, we figured it out. Yeah. So I don't know. We'll get there.
Yeah. This actually goes along with another thing we've been talking about, which is the scratching discs. They haven't admitted that yet, have they?
No, but there's a lawsuit now in California that is seeking a potential, you know, class action status. Of course, the Norwegians are investigating this as well. There's all kinds of little things going on here. You know, Peter Moore, the vice president directly in charge of the Xbox, left the company this week very suddenly.
Yeah, he went to Electronic Arts.
Yeah, and everyone's claiming that this has nothing to do with, you know, the warranty event, and, you know, who can say, but it is kind of an interesting bit of timing. And speaking of interesting timing, you know, Robbie Bach, the guy who was above Peter Moore, he's a senior senior vice president in charge of entertainment and devices. This guy sold, I think it was $6.25 million worth of Microsoft stock in the 6 weeks leading up to this announcement. And at the announcement, he publicly said that Microsoft had known about the problem for months. So he sort of implicated himself there by admitting that, yeah, while he was selling off his stock, the first time he's ever done this, by the way, he knew that Microsoft was going to make this big warranty announcement. And that's potentially insider trading. You know.
Any word of investigation, or is this just now surfacing? And
It's still happening, so I don't know. We'll see. But I find... it's certainly suspicious.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting. And no admission, though, from Microsoft that there's a 360 disk problem.
No. In fact, they continue to say that this is a user error type problem.
What? And, no, you put a disk in, it goes, and then drills.
Oh, I'm very careful. Very careful with this $60 disks, you know. And... yeah, I don't. I've heard the sound. I've seen the deep gouging. I've watched as my Xbox has refused to play the games.
Oh man!
So yeah, I'm holding on to a couple of game discs just to, in the eventual hope that they will own up to this as well. And
you know you've had it because it's a visible gouge in a circle on the disc.
Oh yeah. This is not a scuffing.
No.
You know, it's like you took a sharp knife or something and really. Went at it.
And it goes all the way around, right? Is it like a ring?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Concentric circles.
Yeah, I've seen these too. Mm-hmm. So strange. Well, you'd think they'd admit that. Well, you know, we got to sell some more stock, then we'll admit it. Oh, I shouldn't have said that.
We'll just look forward to Robbie Bach's next stock sell off, and then we'll know the announcement is coming.
Oh, man. Now, that's potentially libelous, is it?
What I just said or what he did?
Yeah, I don't know. Who cares? It's just a podcast.
I'm just...
It's allegedly.
I'm throwing it out there.
Allegedly.
As possible. It's certainly suspicious.
You can say that. You can say suspicious. Yeah. I got a whole lesson at Tech TV in what you could say and could not say.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe I should have had that lesson.
Well, you can't it's libelous if you allege something that's provable. That's a point of fact. So if said
it's certainly a point of fact that he sold stock.
That's
that he did it in weeks leading up to this announcement, and that he said publicly that he knew about it for months.
Right. So there you go. Now, if you said the guy is an inside trader, inside trading, or he's committed a broken that could be considered libelous. But we don't say that. Listen, we said allegedly.
Just saying, it sounds like insider trading. It looks like insider trading.
I did this. I called somebody an extortionist.
An extortionist.
And it turns out you can't say that.
Ah, yes.
So I had
people are awfully touchy.
They are when you call them names.
Oh, name calling and
baby murderer. You know,
charges.
They don't.
So forth.
They don't like that. You can say he's a slime ball. Yes. Ironically, That's not libel because it's not provable. That's just an opinion.
It's an opinion.
It's an opinion.
Okay.
I think he's a low-level life-sucking weasel, but yes. He can't say he's an extortionist because
I won't say I don't know him.
I don't know
if he's a good guy or not. It doesn't. I'm just saying. This all adds up in my head to a bunch of interesting and interrelated events.
Yes.
So history will tell the tale.
Only time, and it's the classic lockout of the local news reporter. Only time will tell.
There you go.
Your software pick of the week, my friend. We didn't do one last time, and everybody, the world is weeping.
I know.
So
that was my fault. I just completely zoned on it.
It's my fault. I zoned on it.
Actually, you're right. It was your fault, and I accept your apology.
It's my fault. I should be the one who's saying, and now, Paul.
Speaking of Stephen Colbert.
It's time.
Yes. Yeah, so we will do it. We will do one this week. At least one. Are you going to do one as well? Or
I could do one if you feel like it. I have a great one, and I can't take credit for it, but there's one I'd like to share with everybody.
Okay.
So let's do yours first.
Okay. So mine is called Pick Me, P-I-C-M-E. You can find it at raiselabs.com, and that's R-A-I-Z-L-A-B-S. And basically what it is a peer-to-peer actually, it's not technically peer-to-peer, but it works like a peer-to-peer photo-sharing application. And the thing that's interesting about it is that it actually is an application, and you run it on your machine where your photos would typically be. And it allows you to share photos in a very, very simple fashion without having to go through a website or any other thing.
Oh, neat.
And if you think about sites like Flickr or Picasso or anywhere else you might go online and try to share photos, one of the difficulties of that is you kind of go in and you set up your account and you want to share photos with your father, maybe your sister, your kids, but you don't necessarily want those out in the wider world, And I know from my own experience, we have a personal website that we had set up specifically because at one time we lived on the other side of the country for most of our family and they wanted to see our kids as they were growing up and we would post pictures. But, I get email, semi-regularly from people who, maybe are wondering why I haven't updated it recently or, it's a little, interesting.
It's been years.
You're not in my family, are you? Why are you emailing me about this? So, one of the issues is it's hard to share things in a secure fashion where you can say, I'm going to open this up to friends and families and to no one else.
You could do it on Flickr, but you just have to remember and it's kind of a pain. And
it's not something, again, we keep going back to my parents as the typical normal, users. I think it would be difficult for them,
So what is PickMe? PickMe allows you to upload them to the PickMe site? Or is it coming off?
Yeah, technically, they actually are stored in a server. So when someone else is accessing your shared photos, they're doing it off the server. So they don't, your computer doesn't have to be on all the time.
Excellent.
You're not going to run into those issues with that sort of thing.
And can they download the pictures and
yeah, depending on how you set it up. Now you may allow them to download them or not. You may allow them to download smaller versions or the full size versions. That's all up to you. And I think this is nice because again in this interconnected world we've been talking about, everyone's online. And I may go on a trip. I'm going to France. I may want to send photos to my parents or my brother and sister or whoever of the trip while we're away. And this is something that will just pop up in this application. And they can, view them as if they were on their own system. And it, by the way, it does so with a presentation that is absolutely first class. Mm. It's a really neat 3D view that supports, the mouse scroll wheel, and you can go up and down, and it's just really, really neat looking.
So, and it's free.
And it is free. And it's free up to a certain number of photos. I want to say 500. And then after that, there's a yearly fee, but it's really reasonable, a very low cost.
Also has a interface directly to Flickr, which is cool.
Yeah, and of course, they're looking at extending that to other photo sharing sites. Most of these places offer up APIs where developers can go in and interact. So Flickr being the biggest, probably, of those sites and the most used.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of a necessity for me because I put a lot of stuff on Flickr. If I do any other sharing, I'm going to have some interface to Flickr for sure.
Yeah, so you could access your Flickr photos through here. You could share your Flickr photos through here so that someone wouldn't have to use a web browser or go to a specific address or whatever.
Excellent,
it is.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's a neat application.
And they're in Brookline.
Yeah, they're in Coolidge Corner.
Historic.
It is historic.
Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool. All right. Yeah. Mine is free also. It is called Launchy. Have you ever heard of Launchy?
I think somebody just emailed me about it.
Yeah, it's brand new. It's launchy.net. It's an open source project. Mm-hmm. And I credit Ryan Yule, who does the Yule's Jewels feature on The Lab, my TV show up in Canada, because he's the free file guy. He found this, and I just love it. I'm a big Quicksilver user on the Macintosh, and I always wanted something like that on the Windows side, where you hit a keystroke, type a couple of letters, kind of like that start menu thing in Vista. But it's even, you know, it's global. It allows you to open bookmarks, folders, files, documents, as well as applications. Great way to send emails. I mean, just everything is just a couple of keystrokes away. Hmm. And I just love that kind of interactivity. It's beautifully done. Very handy. Great way to go to websites that you go to a lot. Play a song. You know, you got a song, named Fire. You just hit the control keys, you assign those, and start typing F-I-R-E, and it'll say, "Yo, you want to play Fire?" And you say, you hit return, and boom, it plays it. Really, really neat. Absolutely free. It's the open source keystroke launcher for Windows. It's called Launchy, and it's from launchy.net. Now, I'm using it on XP. I'm sure it works with Vista, but I'll be honest with you.
Yeah,
I haven't tried it.
You're familiar with Jeff Raskin, right?
Loved him. Right. I say past tense because he passed away.
Right, but you know, it's interesting because his son is around and is in fact kind of pushing the same concepts, and right. He's really into this kind of thing.
Yeah, and in fact, they have a whole kind of demo interface that they were working
on. Yeah, and there's a great video I just watched through another interesting application called Miro, which is a sort of a video player for online stuff.
It's the old Democracy Player. They've renamed it Miro.
Yeah. Yeah. If you go up to Google Video, you can search for something called The Death of the Desktop.
Oh, cool.
And this is an actual Google recorded video of Jeff Raskin's son giving a presentation at Google about, you know, the future of UI and et cetera. And he talks about not Launchy, but Quicksilver and how, you know, these things should be integrated into operating systems and et cetera. It's really interesting, this kind of thing.
It's one of the challenges of a windowed operating system. It, you know, the GUI is great and the mouse is great, but you do spend a lot of time digging through things, or you put all these icons on your desktop. That doesn't work so well either, or in a dock
We're absolutely straining at the edges of this desktop UI interface that we've been using. Yeah.
That's why I think try Launchy. I think you'll like it. There are similar things. ActiveWords does something similar. There are a number of similar applications. This one's free, and I think does exactly what I wanted it to do anyway. So nice. A couple of good software picks for you. Book pick as well. Let's remind you from audible.com at audible.com/Windows. Our book pick is The Hitchhiker, a great one, a classic, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Stephen Fry reads the Douglas Adams classic. We will be back next week live on Talk Shoe, unless it's another big heavy news week.
we had 2 weeks this time, so yeah, we had a lot. It was a little harder with all the stuff going on.
And we wanted to get all this in, but we will take your calls and questions again live on, it'll be in on Thursday, July 26th. At 4 p.m. Eastern Time at TalkShoe.com. Look for the Windows Weekly Live, and we'll do that on TalkShoe. So that's fun. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Thank you, Paul Thurrott. Don't forget, Paul's websites are, of course, the super site for Windows at WinSue. What are you laughing at? You got to get the plug dude. I'm not paying you. Actually, I am paying you. Wait a minute. You get paid for these Audible ads.
Do you have a website, Leo? You must have a website.
I don't plug my website. It's Twit. Everybody knows. You Google Twit. I put that on my business cards. No name, no address, nothing.
Google Twit.
Google Twit.
Huh.
I'm the number one result.
You are. I was going to say, you are kind of a twit.
I'm the number one twit.
That was so much meaner than I meant it to
You are so mean. I'm going to cry right now.
Sorry.
And I was about to tell everybody to go to a Supersite for Windows.
Exactly. Well, now you can just forget it.
WinSupersite.com and, of course, internet-nexus.com is Paul's blog. And make sure you get his new book. I've been reading it. In fact, it's funny. I just had it out open the other night because I was looking for doing some reference on Vista. It's Windows Secrets for Vista. Windows Vista Secrets from Wiley & Sons and in all the better bookstores. It's the Vista book to get. There's no question about that. And we thank you, Paul. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly.